So the last invited speaker of this conference is Rachel Mabry, and she used to be at our School of Communication Sciences and Disorders for a couple of years, and I had the pleasure to meet her here. But then she left us, and she is now a professor in linguistics at UCSD in San Diego. And as probably every one of you knows, she is the expert in the field of sign language and neurocognition of sign language, and she uses this to track down changes due to critical periods and so on. It's really amazing work. And so I give you Rachel Mabry with a talk on when language of language acquisition matters, brain language processing effects of learning a first language in adolescence. Thanks.
Thank you. When I was a student here, I never dreamed I would speak at the faculty club. In fact, when I was a student here, I didn't even think I knew there was a faculty club. But I do have to say that my research path is actually due to a person on my dissertation committee who was extremely negative about what I wanted to pursue, because I was very interested in how language modality affected language comprehension and how sign language comprehension might differ from gestural and pantomime comprehension and spoken language comprehension. And he said to me, well, this is bah humbug. This is not an interesting topic, because everybody knows that anybody can understand any sign language, anywhere, at any time. So thank you to this negative. So I decided that I had to see whether this was so. So what I want to talk about today is how the study of sign language actually gives us a lot of information about bilingualism, about the acquisition of first and second languages, and also about neural cognition. But first, I have to, not all of you know about sign or sign research, so I have to share some facts with you so we're all on the same page and so you can understand the designs and paradigms of my work. Then I want to talk about research that we've done to show that the effects of age of acquisition are quite different for first versus second language acquisition. Then what I really want to share with you, this is all background, is some recent work that we have been doing studying language acquisition in teenagers who have no language until they are immersed in sign. I want to talk about the course of their language acquisition, and I also want to talk about their what their brains seem to be doing with language. So first, a few facts about sign language. We don't know how many sign languages there are in the world. There are over 130 documented sign languages, and this is a very exciting time for sign language research. New sign languages are being discovered literally every month. Sign languages emerge where there are groups of deaf people, where there are strong genetic deafness. There is sign language has been discovered in Israel, Al-Sayed Bedouin sign language, in Bali, Katakolik, where there's a group of deaf people, also in Ghana, where there's a long history of genetic deafness. Deaf people there use Atamorobi sign language. And also in Kenya, where there are newly formed schools for the deaf, and new sign languages are rising and evolving very quickly. And this is just a sample of the sign languages that are newly discovered and are evolving. Now, I'm sure that you all know that sign languages have linguistic structure, and that you can all imagine that signs have syntactic structure, that they have word order. Even if you don't know sign, you can intuitively imagine that there would be morphology on signs. What's harder for people who don't know sign to really intuit or imagine is that signs have sublexical structure. And this sublexical structure distinguishes signs from gestures. And this sublexical structure in sign actually arises from the interplay of the brain's need to coordinate the two hands, the two articulators, to create single lexical items. So I have these films from Kenyan Sign. This is the only place in the world that my films aren't working. So But what these films show is that these are three different examples of sign from Kenyan sign. And in the first sign, the two hands have the same hand shape, and the movement is alternating. In the second example, the two hands are moving, but one hand is operating on the other hand. And in the third example, only one hand is moving. So a while ago, Robin Battison discovered that the sublexical structure of signs is guided by what he calls symmetry and dominance. Symmetry and dominance simply means that the two hands operate together. And in fact, when we look across sign languages, old sign languages and new sign languages, we see, in fact, that the majority of signs are made with one hand. We see that actually another large majority of signs are made with two hands. But the special feature of these two-handed signs is that the hand shapes of both of the hands that are moving are identical. And the movement is either symmetrical or parallel. There is a third type of sign, and this is unbalanced, and this is where the two hands have two different hand shapes. In this particular case, the dominant hand operates on the non-dominant hand. You can see here that these two kinds of signs with two different kinds of hand shapes are relatively infrequent in sign languages, and what's really interesting here is that it's across sign languages. And especially interesting is that for these signs where the two hands have two different hand shapes, across sign languages, researchers have discovered that there are only six hand shapes that can occur on the non-dominant hand. So these seem to be universal articulatory constraints that are apparent in the lexicon of signs languages around the world. So when people learn sign, they not only have to learn word order and morphology, but they also have to learn the sublexical structure, which is akin to the phonological structure of language, and they have to learn these particular constraints, although nobody ever teaches it to signers. So now, what about sign language informing first versus second language acquisition? So in any deaf community, except for those communities where everybody is deaf and there's strong genetic deafness, only 10% of the deaf population or deaf signers have deaf parents. This means that 90% of deaf signers in any random sample of any deaf community will have learned sign language not from their parents but outside of the home. So this means that 90% of signers, any random sample of signers, are either L2 learners of sign or they're first language learners of sign. And so what we do in our research is, what we've tried to do is see, in fact, whether this is similar, first versus second language acquisition. So you can learn sign as a baby, you can be hearing or deaf and have deaf parents, or you can learn sign as a second language, be you hearing or deaf. And this is exactly the case that we have in spoken language research with bilingualism. Unique to the sign case, however, is that there are large numbers of deaf children who first learn sign when they are in late childhood or adolescence, and they have very little language. They can't, this is because they're born deaf, and if nobody signs to them, they don't see sign language. If they don't get special intervention, they can't hear language. And we know that there's not enough articulatory information on the lips for children to spontaneously acquire language by simply looking at the mouth. Otherwise, there wouldn't be sign languages because there wouldn't be a need for sign languages. But in addition, there are many, many children or adolescents who learn no language until they are teens or they are adults. This is very common in countries outside of North America. And actually, it's much more common in North America than you would imagine. So what we do in this work is we do contrasts between native language acquisition of ASL versus second language acquisition, late first language acquisition versus second language acquisition. So the question is, do we find differences? Is it simply age of acquisition that determines the outcome of language acquisition and or neural processing, or are there special effects for the critical period on first language acquisition? So in one study we did, actually here in Montreal, we did two studies where we actually demonstrated that the effects of age of acquisition are much greater for the first language than the second language. In one study, we compared people who were born deaf versus people who lost their hearing in adolescence using a sentence memory task, and we saw that the second language learners outperformed the late first language learners. In a replication study, we changed the language to English, and we used written English, and we compared hearing people who are non-English speakers on a grammatical judgment task of English with deaf people who learned ASL from birth, who are second language learners of English, and both sets of second language learners performed comparably, but much better than a group of deaf people who had no language until late childhood. So in another set of studies, also done here at McGill, at the Montreal Neurological Institute, we looked to see whether we could find effects on neural processing. And in this particular study, we used a grammatical judgment task in American Sign Language. All of the utterances were monoclausal and simple. And we tested a range of deaf people, a group of deaf people randomly selected who had learned age of acquisition at a variety of ages. In particular, what we found was that there were 9 areas in the brain that were highly sensitive or responsive to age of acquisition, and a whole cluster of areas were in the left hemisphere, in the language network, and surprisingly and unpredictably, there were areas in the occipital lobe that were also sensitive to age of acquisition in these deaf signers, all of whom were first learners of sign, and in particular, what we didn't expect and what is particularly unique is that for the areas in the left hemisphere language areas, what we see is a decrease in neural activation the older the person was when they were first exposed to language. And then we have a corollary effect in the occipital lobe, which is that the older the person was when he or she first learned how to sign, the more activation there is in the occipital lobe. So here we see a trade-off in activation in the language area versus the area that's doing the visual perception of sign. So the real question, this is all the background, the real question I wanted to talk to you about, and the research I wanted to talk to you about, is how language acquisition proceeds when, in fact, it is begun in adolescence. And to do this, actually, this was a study that just came to us. Some people contacted our laboratory, and they wanted to know if we could help or if we were interested in studying the language of 3 adolescents, all of whom had been discovered in San Diego, and were taken from their homes or where they lived. They were all deaf, they were all born deaf, and they were placed in a group home where everybody used sign. All the staff, the students, everybody was a deaf signer. And the whole focus of the education that these 3 cases received was, in fact, to learn how to sign. So their research names, we call them Carlos, Cody, and Shauna. Carlos is from Mexico, from a large family of 7 deaf children. He was born profoundly deaf. He was the only deaf person in his family. There was no school available to him. He was nurtured and loved, unlike children who were abused. He came to the United States with his father because people told his father that if he came to the United States, that Carlos would be able to hear and be able to speak. Cody was born profoundly deaf, and he was misdiagnosed. His deafness was not understood. People didn't understand that the reason he couldn't speak was because he was deaf, and he went from placement to placement to placement. He lived with a foster mother who was hearing, who did not know how to sign, and when she passed away, authorities discovered that he was a teen and had no language. Shauna is an American child who was born profoundly deaf. She was given to a foster family, and they decided for unknown reasons that they should homeschool her. She never had any interaction with special education. So when we met these three, and when we first saw these three adolescents, they were reported to, and we can verify they knew no signs, had no speech, could not speech read, could not read, and could not write. But they were the perfect natural experiment in that, in this group home, they were immersed in ASL. They saw ASL 24/7. People worked with them. Deaf people tried to teach them how to sign. And so what we did with these three individuals was to follow their language using a traditional language acquisition approach. We took spontaneous language samples. We coded the samples. We then parsed the samples to look at their sentence length, the kind of morphology they used, MLU, etc. What's particularly interesting, so the first thing that we did is we looked at the vocabulary that they learned. One thing that we found is that they learned signs pretty quickly and that they tended not to use gestures at all. This is the makeup, the vocabulary makeup of Shauna. And you can see here that like children who were acquiring English, the bulk of her words are nouns. She also has verbs. She has a few closed class words and other kinds of words as well. Now, remember that she is American and she was kept at home. What's particularly interesting is that Carlos, who's from Mexico and who interacted with all of these people in his village and with his family, is a completely different kind of communicative experience that he, too, was acquiring the very same kinds of words, signs, that Shauna was, that these were primarily concrete nouns and verbs. And, in fact, they were actually acquiring the same kinds of closed class words. They were in the same kind of environment. And so this particular kind of acquisition pattern actually is reminiscent of one that's been reported in the literature for normally hearing children who have been adopted at a young age into North America, and we find that they acquire words very quickly and that they seem to acquire the same kinds of concrete words and the same kinds of verbs. We see the same thing happening in ASL. When we look, as you all know, or that mean length of utterance, how long an utterance is in terms of the number of signs and in terms of the number of morphology, is a terrific metric for how the child's language is progressing. So the longer the MLU, here we're measuring it in signs and in also sign morphemes, the more complex the child's language. We see that for Carlos and Shauna, and they're arranged this way because Shauna's been immersed here for 12 months. Cody has been immersed for 24 months, and Carlos has been immersed for 36 months. As is the case for normal language acquisition, we see a very high correlation between the number of vocabulary items that they are acquiring and the complexity of their sentence structures. But one of the things that is particularly interesting is that they seem to acquire a vocabulary of 500 to 600 words. They have done that, and they are able to put signs together in simple sentences, but they have not, after 6 years, gone beyond these simple sentences. Their sentences are declarative. Their verbs are plain. They don't inflect their verbs. They haven't acquired any pronouns. They can't ask any questions that are generated with morphosyntax, and they have no conjunction and no embedding. So it's as if they have taken the first few steps towards language acquisition, but they cannot go further, so that they're not acquiring the complex language that we would definitely expect a child have acquired if they were acquiring their first language. And so we're continuing to follow their language, and another important aspect of their language acquisition is that they have very poor comprehension of language. And so people often overestimate their comprehension because they don't seem to produce their signs more slowly than anyone else, and they have a lot to say, but they say it in very simple sentences with uninflected morphology. So the really intriguing question is, what are these individuals, what are their brains doing with signs? Can we figure out a way to neuroimage these cases to inform the critical period. So we know that the left hemisphere areas are responsible for language actually from birth in normally hearing children, although we have learned at this conference that there seems to be a bit of a difference if you're bilingual. But what if, in fact, your brain hasn't received any structured language for the first 13 years of your life? Is it the case that the left hemisphere network for language is so deeply innate that it doesn't require any stimulus to linguistic stimulus to do its work? Or does it, in fact, it require linguistic stimulation to get up and running, so to speak? So to do this particular study, we were very fortunate to be able to use some anatomically constrained magnetoencephalography. So, and for short, we call this AMIG. And so AMIG is a procedure that actually combines the temporal qualities of EEG with the spatial qualities of MRI. So the way this works is the subject sits in here. This is called a Dewar. It looks like they're about ready to be beamed up to Mars or something like this. They sit in a magnetically shielded room because, in fact, what we were doing or is measuring the electrical response of their synapses. And in the Dewar, there are 306 sensors that are picking up this electrical activity. The electrical activity that we get, the magnetic activity that we get from gravity is greater than the activity that is emanated from the brain. And in fact, they have to sit in a magnetically shielded room, which some subjects don't like to go into. So each of these 306 sensors gives a continuous recording. And so here you see one particular continuous recording. And all of these 306 sensors are time-locked to the stimuli so that we can get readings from all across the brain in response to particular stimuli. What we're looking for is the standard kind of N400 effect that people have been talking about, and then we time-lock this N400 effect to the various stimuli. But we go a step further, which is that in addition to doing MEG recordings from each subject, we also do an MRI of each subject's brain. And then we map the signal from the 306 sensors to the subject's brain, so to specific landmarks in the subject's brain. And then we can look at the brain in terms of these sensors, and we also inflate the brain so that we can have a good look at the gyri and sulci. And then we can map, because we have continuous recording, sensor recordings from across the brain, we map those continuous recordings to where they are happening in the brain as a function of time. So here you could see at 100 milliseconds in the occipital lobe, there'd be activation. So, here we can see with the MEG response, the language coursing through the brain for written words. This experiment we made specifically for these cases. What we used was a picture sign priming paradigm, and we used only vocabulary that we knew was that these kids knew. And we designed the entire study around their particular vocabulary. This is what the stimuli looks like. We use a match-mismatch kind of paradigm. This didn't work. You would see a picture of an apple and a sign apple, which would be the match, and a picture of a chair and a sign apple would be a mismatch. So the question is, these are MEG responses. One set of brains, one is normally hearing. The other set of brains is deaf. One set of brains is responding to words on pictures, or words in response to pictures, and the other brain is responding to signs and pictures. Can you tell which one that is which? What we find looking at deaf native signers watching signs in this paradigm, a match-mismatch paradigm, and normally hearing adults who are listening to words and watching to pictures, we get identical responses. We get an N400 that converges in the temporal lobe with some right hemisphere activity. In case you're still trying to puzzle out which is the hearing brain and which is the deaf brain, the upper brain is the hearing people listening to spoken words in response to pictures, and the bottom brains are deaf native signers responding to signs in response to pictures. Now, what about our late learners? So here we have one subject, and you've seen this response before. This is the response to the incongruity response to pictures for one native signer. Here we have a group of 11 hearing people who learned ASL as a second language, and they have been signing for 1 to 2 years. And you can see here that at the single word level, their response to signs is identical to that of deaf native signers. Now, what about the late cases? This is the neural response of Carlos, and you can see that his responses to single words. Now, you should know that he's very accurate on his task. He was 85% accurate, and that the speed of his responding was within 1.5 standard deviations of the L2 learners. So his brain responses to words that he actually understands. And what we see is a very strong right hemisphere response, a strong response in the superior parietal lobe, and particularly the dorsal pathway. And this is for Shauna. She has been signing now for 3 years. In addition, she was highly accurate. She had an 87% accuracy rate. She was nearly as fast as the L2 signers. And you see that also she has her primary response is in the right hemisphere and the superior parietal lobe. And both of these subjects show, again, very strong use of the dorsal pathway, the right dorsal pathway, in understanding signs. So we're wondering, in fact, if this might give us some clues as to how these two individuals are learning language. And here we come back to the sublexical structure of signs. I want you to remember that these two cases had no language when they were immersed in sign. They didn't have words for dog and cat and mom and milk and sleep and wake up. They not only did they have to learn the meanings of these words, but they had to learn the hand shapes and the movements and the places of articulation in the body for each sign, because if you don't do that, nobody can understand you. And if you don't do it correctly, you can't understand other people. So one of the things that the right dorsal pathway is really good at is, in fact, trying to figure out motor movements and human movements that, in fact, you're unfamiliar with. And, in fact, there's a study that asked normally hearing people who didn't know any sign to look at ASL signs, and they got a very strong response from the right dorsal pathway. So it's possible that when you're learning language for the first time at a late age, that an enormous amount of attention and effort has to be paid to learning all of the phonetic categories and articulatory features of signs, in addition to building a semantic network. So we are following these two cases here. They have been signing for 2 to 3 years, and we're re-neuroimaging them. We also, it turns out, that there are a number of immigrants who were in the San Diego area who have not learned how to sign, had no language until they were 20 or 30 years old. They have graciously volunteered for our studies, and I'm pleased and saddened to tell you that we've been able to replicate these findings in other signers as well. So I hope that by doing this extra speedy tour through sign language research and looking at the questions of age of acquisition effects on the linguistic outcome of language learning and also the neural outcome of language learning and also neural processing, that you can see that there are questions that we can ask about the critical period for language with deaf signers that we cannot ask with normally hearing people. And it's through this comparison of people who have language and have not had language language that we're able to see that, in fact, there probably is a critical period for language acquisition. It probably is for the first language. It's clearly not an all-or-none phenomenon where people can't learn any language. People clearly are able to learn how to communicate, but they seem to be maxed out at a very simple level of language learning. And so far as we can tell at this point, it seems that the left hemisphere network for language processing does require linguistic input. It does have to be engaged from birth in order to show what we think of as the normal canonical functioning of the left hemisphere. And before I stop, I have an enormous number of people that I have to acknowledge for funding. I want to thank UCSD for giving us seed money, the Kavli Institute for Mind and Brain for giving us more seed money, to Eric Hallgren for allowing us to borrow money from his NSF grant so that we could do this work until we got our own NIH grant. I would like to acknowledge all of the clever people in my lab, Eric Hallgren and Matt Leonard, Naya Faran, and Marla Hatrack worked really hard on this neuroimaging study. And if you want to see more of our papers or more information, here's our website. Thank you. Sorry.
Okay, we have time for one question.
Can you show us the graph with the results again of the last graph? I got the impression that you were saying the deaf native learner and the hearing late L2 learner, they are not very different from one another.
These two.
But I mean, couldn't you say, just from looking at the picture, that the hearing L2 learner also shows some right hemisphere activation
true,
in the dorsal. So in a way, I get a three-way distinction out of this graph. You know, you get the deaf native learner that shows basically nothing in the right hemisphere, and then you get these very late L1 learners who show dominant activation in the right hemisphere, and the L2 is in between. Isn't that?
Yes.
Wouldn't that be appropriate?
Yes, I mean, these pictures, we also do statistics on the activations in the various regions of interest. And so what is also the case that we see here in when we have group data, these are group data, and the slide that I just showed you were individual subjects that were selected to be representative. In the group data for both normally hearing people who are native English speakers, and for native signers, you see that there is some right hemisphere activation, but it's not significant if you were to do tests for right versus left hemisphere. So it's not the case that native signers or native speakers at the single word level show no right hemisphere activation. They do show some. They just show much more. But I agree with you that I don't mean to leave you with the impression that with 2 years of sign language learning that your lexical processing will be identical to a native. But you certainly have a huge head start over somebody who didn't have language. You're close, and you have a huge head start over somebody who didn't have language. Thank you for that question.